Welcome to Meet the Entertainers on the Big Ben Show. And today we're talking to Bryson Lang, who has a comedy juggling act. He's a fantastic guy, works out of the United States. What a great guy. Works on the other side of the planet to me. So there's lots of differences in how he got his big break, how he got started. But there's also such a lot of things in common. If you want to check him out, please do go to his website, www.brysonlang.com. Bryson is B-R-Y-S-O-N, Lang is L-A-N-G. If you want to check me out, my website is www.thebigbenshow.com. Once again, this podcast was recorded on Skype, so the audio quality is so-so. And if you want to be interviewed, please do get in touch with me. My email is ben@thebigbenshow.com. And on these sites like iTunes, I'm only putting up about 3 or 4 podcasts. So if you want to check out all the old episodes, then go to my website, www.thebigbenshow.com. And there on the main page, if you scroll down, you can see links to all the other podcast interviews that I've done. All right, let's go over and talk to Mr. Bryson Lang. Right, so, okay, Bryson Lang, thank you very much for talking to me. What is it that you do? Just say very... If someone's asking you, they meet you for the first time, what is it that you do?
I usually tell them I have a comedy juggling act that I perform around the world.
There you go. Brilliant.
That's the short version.
Yeah. All right, and... Well, let's get right into it. What's your life story? How did you get started? Where did this come from?
I had an interest in all kinds of variety arts when I was younger, but as you know, there wasn't a whole lot of there was no internet, there was no access to it.
Yeah.
So when I met a guy in college who was a juggler, he had just gone to his first IJA convention,
uh-huh.
And he was completely energized and you know. Had all this passion for it, and when I met him, he was already juggling. He knew how to juggle 5 balls, and I had very little experience. And I mean, the short version is I met him. He showed me the ropes. We started learning to pass clubs, and then I found something that I was, you know, as interested in anything else. It became a new passion, interest.
Yeah, it looks to me from your videos that you're quite a natural, you're quite a skillful juggler, much more skillful than me.
Well, I don't know. I mean, obviously we all started out, a lot of us start out with the intention of being technical, you know, gurus, and then at some point that shifts when we either A, realize it's probably not practical, and B, we'd like to make some money.
Yeah.
You know, it may not be realistic for everybody. I certainly spent, you know, like many people, hours in the gym trying to be the next star, but I really started kind of late.
Okay. How old were you when you started juggling?
I mean, I learned how to juggle as a kid. You know, you see it somewhere in your life and you think, I bet I could do that. And you grab 3 things and then I just kind of put it down and never, I didn't know there was more to it.
Yeah.
It wasn't until I got to college in, you know, when I was 18 or so that I discovered the rest of that world.
Yeah. Oh.
So I've always had an interest in magic, I've always had an interest in juggling and the variety act world, but once I hit college, that was where it really became, you know, it opened up to me and it became something I was pursuing myself instead of just seeing it in a circus or seeing it on TV occasionally or whenever we could.
I think this is a common thread. There's a lot of performers who are in their early to mid-40s who started juggling at college about 1990, somewhere around there, end of the 80s, start of the 90s.
Yeah.
And there's a whole bunch of us. There's a whole generation.
And
it's very similar for me. I mean, I was at university, I joined the juggling club, got really hooked, became the president of the juggling club, and it was at university. There was a boom in Europe. Maybe someone had finally worked out how to mass produce plastic juggling clubs or something. For some reason, it took off, and and we had the really big European juggling conventions started happening. And then we used to get our VHS videotapes of the IJA conventions from America, and we thought, this is amazing, we must do some of this.
Yeah, well, that was you know, when I was thinking about speaking to you, I was thinking back on how everything, where we got our exposure to it all. And when I first got interested in all of this, like I said before, it was a time where we didn't have the internet. All we had was, occasionally you'd catch it on TV, occasionally you'd catch it live, but occasionally you'd meet somebody who knew somebody that had a stack of videotapes.
That's right.
And it was like the Holy Grail. I mean, it was unbelievable. And so that we had to fight for that kind of footage, and it meant so much when you knew that, you know, sifting through these videotapes meant everything to me.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Oh, gosh. Yeah. We used to watch, we had one VHS tape of of maybe in 1987 IGA, which featured a lot of Anthony Gatto. We were like, oh my goodness, and had Michael Menez opening the tape. That was great stuff.
Yeah, that was, and then it's funny to think how things have changed, where now, you know, I don't say we take it for granted, but you can get anything you want if you need, you know, you can, I've got all the footage on video, but you can get it at your fingertips in seconds on YouTube.
So I know. It's amazing how it's changed.
Yeah.
All right. So juggling is something you really get into at college. You're already, yes. You already had an interest in variety acts and magic, yep, as a kid. Is that right?
Yeah. My grandfather was a professional magician in the Chicago area, and he was he did very well, and it was a big part of his life, a big passion. And he died when I was two, so I didn't really have a chance to kind of connect with him on that. But I have, actually over to my right, I have all of his stuff. So I have his books and I have his materials and his notes.
Wow. When
he typed all the tricks. And so that definitely helped. But then, you know, I didn't really pursue it myself in terms of trying to learn card tricks or anything. I think I noticed early and often that there's so many people that are so good at cards.
Yeah.
It just wasn't, and also I just didn't have the knack for it.
Mm-hmm.
I preferred the more physical, you know, learning how to juggle than I did the close-up. But I have such an appreciation and respect for magic, and I've always followed it, tried to stay close to it, become familiar with it, be able to do what I call is to talk fluently in the world of magic, so that when I work with magicians, they don't feel like, oh, this guy's not one of us.
Mm.
I like being able to sort of sift right in and filter in with them, and then they go, sorry, what do you do? And I say, oh, I'm a juggler. And they sort of think, why do you know so much about this other world? And I just say, well, it behooves me to keep up with it all.
Are you in Hong Kong, because there's not many of us, we can get to do a little bit of everything. We can kind of become all-rounders. So one day I might be doing I began as a juggler and unicyclist, but one day I might be doing stilts. One day I might be asked to do a close-up magic. I do a lot of different bits and bobs. I'm not very good at any of them, but overall I'm a pretty good all-rounder. In America, do you specialize in comedy juggling, or do you actually get a chance to do other things like magic? I'd imagine not. I imagine the market there is you are a comedy juggler, and that's your specialty. That's what you do.
I think in general people tend to specialize. I know that there's definitely people out there that consider themselves, you know, all around comedy juggler or juggler magician. You know, sometimes balloons, a whole bunch of things at once.
Mm.
I have a little tiny bit of magic that I do in my show occasionally, but I don't know if you find this. Almost everybody in my entire world just thinks I'm a magician.
Yes. Well,
is it a common affliction?
I think so. Well, I thought it was because I work in places like Singapore and Hong Kong where English is often a second language. And so you say the word juggler and they don't know what you mean, so I normally say, oh yes, I'm a magician. But apparently in America it's also the case, is that right?
I it's a strange phenomenon, but I think part of it, to be fair, part of it has to do with I do know a lot about magic, and I'm enthusiastic about it, and people tend to ask me, you know, laymen tend to ask me questions, or, you know, family members or sisters-in-law or whatever, and I think a lot of the shows that I've been in have been magic shows that have an extra, you know, feature another act, so that I think that's they hear the word magic over and over, and I think magic's obviously, it's a bigger category. I think their minds just default to, well, he must be a magician because, you know, who juggles for a living?
He does shows in cruise ships. He does shows at corporate events. Must be a magician. That's what magicians do.
Yeah. I definitely think there's something to be said for juggler is not a job in most people's minds. But I know the magician is because I've seen it on TV and I know people headline as magicians. I think that's what people's minds do.
Out of our niche of variety entertainment, magicians are the only ones who ever get mildly famous or even very famous. Never heard of a famous, and no layman's ever heard of a famous juggler, really.
No, they just know of a famous person who they know can juggle.
Yeah.
They also, you know, can do other things, but yeah, I just think it's a bigger category, and it's, even after I've done a show, people will come up and say, my son loved your magic. I don't know, it's just, I think people's brains, that's where they go, it's just what happens.
Yeah. Alright, so you're at college, and there's a friend who's already been to the IJA, and you're getting inspired. How in America did you make the transition from it being a hobby, that big leap, to it becoming a professional, that's your career?
I definitely have a, my life was going to be non-traditional either way, no matter what I did. You know, I was already, I'm a guitar player, and my life was heading toward being a guitar player.
I saw your video, one of your video clips, you playing the guitar, you're amazing!
Oh, really?
Yeah!
Well, I've been playing I play in a band here in Massachusetts, and I've played in a few, and it's something I do for fun, but back then, my plan was to become a famous guitar player, and instead I became an obscure, you know, non-famous juggler, so I don't know. It was something that happened by accident, but yeah, my plan was, I'm in music school, I'm a guitar player, this is the path that I'm on, and I think the performing part of it is important to acknowledge that when I got interested in variety act stuff and being a juggler and being a comedian, that became an equal pursuit. And then it was sort of a question of, well, along the way I've learned from talking to people and being around variety artists and I've learned how to approach it and become how to make money at it. In terms of guitar, I don't really know how to make money at it. So I sort of started just pursuing.
But how did you know at college that you could make money out of it? Did you know people? You met people at the IJAs?
I think what happened was I had so much, you know, I watched so many different acts, and I saw so many different styles, and I saw people that were doing it and had made it to the Tonight Show and all these things. And I thought, well, these guys are doing it, and I'm going to conventions and I'm meeting them personally. I had access to the stars, celebrities in the variety world. It just seemed more accessible.
Okay.
Not necessarily easy, but something that, you know, there must be, I can get some wisdom from this, more quickly than you can't really call up Eddie Van Halen and say, what do we do? How does this work? And so I think the guitar didn't take a back seat, but juggling and comedy moved to the forefront.
Oh yeah, I can see that. Yeah.
Every opportunity in college to get on stage, I did, whether it was a talent show or, you know, Night at the Apollo or some kind of a contest, and almost every time it had to do something with either juggling or magic or something.
So was there a turning point where you? Was there a key turning point where you became professional? Was it gradual? You got more and more paid shows?
I think it was, well, during college there weren't a lot of paid shows.
No,
During college was really just getting over the intense fear of being in front of people.
Right.
And I'm naturally a very shy person, and I'm naturally terrified of being on stage. So for me, doing a show is probably, it's more of a goal that I get through every time.
And, yeah.
So for me, it was really, I mean, college audiences are tough. It's a bunch of people folded arms and they're just looking at you like, you know, you're guilty until proven funny, you know? And so that training ground for me was, if I can get through this weekend and through this talent show, I will feel so good about myself. And you know, we videotaped everything. And then after a couple of years of that, me and this other guy working as a team, then I think we started looking around at preschool, at grade schools and trying to see if we could do shows, even if it was for free.
Mm.
But eventually we started doing some fairs and some other things, but I definitely didn't have my bearings when it came to the work ethic yet. It was just for fun. Like, you know, I'm still in school and I'm going to keep practicing, but if we can do some shows here or there.
Yes.
Started, you know, I did a few and that was gradual.
All right. And then when you finished school, did you have to get a real job?
Here's where I got very lucky.
Ah.
When I finished college, I fell right into doing a year traveling and performing with Sesame Street Live.
Oh, fantastic.
So a friend said that this one of the tours needed a big bird.
Yeah, yeah.
And said, you're 6 feet tall, you'd be perfect for Big Bird, and I know the choreographer, and I know they need a Big Bird. And I said, I can't dance. And they said, it doesn't matter.
Wow.
So I sent them a videotape of me doing a very awkward time step and a couple of other rudimentary dance moves, and they hired me.
Wow.
So, you know, within a few weeks, I was off on a year-long tour.
As Big Bird.
As Big Bird.
That was brilliant.
Yeah. So the good side of that is I was employed for the next year, and I had nothing but high ceilings in arenas to practice backstage.
Oh,
for a year.
Okay.
And I was getting paid, and I was on this equity tour, and in the meantime, I could sort of plot my next step.
Yeah.
The only downside to doing Sesame Street Live and playing in all these arenas and having tour jackets and being part of this, you know, iconic show is that it takes a long time for that, the stink of that to wear off.
And oh, you are the Big Bird fan. You are the Sesame
Street. Right. So, and I would never change it, but for years I was known as, everybody introduced me like, oh, this is my nephew. This guy played Big Bird, and that's all, you know, forever.
Wow.
Yeah, it was very interesting. But I feel very lucky to have had that experience, and it was extremely surreal to be, you know, on the same stage that I had seen Bon Jovi, you know, 4 years earlier.
Gosh.
In a giant Big Bird costume.
Well, how old were you when you were doing this?
I would have been, so that would have been the 93-94 tour, so I was 23 and 24.
Yeah. Oh, that's brilliant.
Yeah.
So straight out of college, you're actually a professional, you're making money, you're a professional entertainer.
Yeah, yeah, and it was great because, you know, everybody in the tour, the crew, had worked with everybody else under the sun, so I could talk to the costume lady when she had done costume work for juggler Tommy Curtin years ago in an ice show, and
yeah.
She knew who Albert Lucas was, and for me it was fantastic.
Oh, that's amazing.
And also something, you know, there's something that really is, it boosts your ego a little bit when you walk out on stage, and even though they're not cheering for me, they're cheering for Big Bird, it's thousands of people.
Yes. Oh, that's incredible.
This is, you're sort of behind the mask, but you still sort of secretly, you know, accept the applause.
Well, they're still cheering and clapping at you. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I still have to pull off the choreography, but that was a great training ground for me to just sort of be on stage and be part of something, and also have time, not be under the pressure of, well, now what? I'm out of college.
Hmm. And when that finished, did you go solo straight away?
Yeah, once that finished, that was when the theme park episodes began. You know, when I was on that tour, I sent a promo package to Hershey Park in Pennsylvania, and they hired me. So I was, again, very lucky. I went right from the tour to half of a season in a show at Hershey Park.
Oh.
which led me to meeting somebody who was very important, another friend of mine, and then he was planning to go to California, I was planning to go to California, and then that saga started.
Wow.
Out west.
Wow. Oh, my
God.
Yeah. Is that a typical, well, I don't suppose there's anything typical about our careers. Is that an unusual way to get into your job?
The theme parks?
Yeah.
I think a lot of jugglers and magicians out here do theme park work, especially in the beginning.
Yeah.
If you're just sort of roving or doing walk around stuff, it doesn't pay really well. But if you're in your early 20s, it's a foot in the door.
Yeah, yeah.
And often theme parks have shows. So for me, I worked a lot of different theme parks, but some of them had shows that ended up being sort of seasonal, consistent work.
Yeah, yeah.
So everything from, Hershey Park, Six Flags, Busch Gardens, what else? Disney, Knott's Berry Farm, some of these U.S. theme parks was great. And some of it was being part of a show, and some of it was doing my own act. And at that point, I didn't have much of an act. It was just, a handful of skills and some ideas and a love of comedy and juggling.
Yeah, okay, so let's talk about your act then. Let's start kind of part two here. Can we go through your current shows sort of bit by bit? Are there any bits that have stayed from when you were 22 or you still do? Okay, how do you start your show?
Now?
Yeah. What is your act now?
The act now is, it's all obviously evolved over the years,
yeah.
But it still has the same sort of structure of. The whole show is sort of split between performance to music and then some kind of a comedy routine, usually with a volunteer and, accomplishing some kind of goal.
Mm-hmm.
If I were to break it down, to the essentials, that's mostly what it is. Occasionally I do something that's a little more surreal that I usually like and some percentage of the audience likes.
I know where you're coming, yes.
You and I would like, but everybody else is, there's a third of the audience that's like, I don't know what's
happening. Yeah, my favorite show is also my most unsuccessful show, because I did a show where I was a sort of a Jimi Hendrix rock and roll figure who supposedly combined rock music and juggling, and I really enjoyed playing it, but nobody else really got it in the crowd, especially in Singapore.
right. Well, you got that cultural difference too. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, when I first saw your videos, I thought, this guy, he does lots and lots and lots of comedy talking, and you're brilliant at it. And then I saw a clip of one of your shows beginning, and I saw you start with music.
Yeah, I have to say, I probably adhere to an old formula, which is come out to music and try to hit him with something,
yeah,
that you're super confident with or that kind of thing. But I do see these days, I feel like there's no one formula. I see people do all kinds of stuff. So I think I've been sort of hanging in there with the old formula of either.
Well, no, I think it's
free balls or glow balls.
I also start with music. I don't think of it as an old formula. I think of it as a very good way to start the show. I mean, you start with something high energy, lots of music, for it maybe quite choreographed, bang, 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 music gets the audience's attention.
Right.
And then for me, my show's always in sort of three parts. There's the bang, 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 music start, then there's the middle bit, which is sort of talking, and then there's the last bit, which will be some kind of big trick for a big finish.
Right. One thing I've noticed in the last couple of years is it takes a little of the edge off if I talk to the audience beforehand.
Ah.
It depends on what kind of show. If it's a corporate show or a cruise, there's a certain, decorum or something that you you don't cross that line beforehand. But if it's a really kind of casual show or a summer show or camp or a school or something, sometimes I'll just wander through the audience and with the mic on and just make jokes about, boy, I hope this guy's good or whatever. And get people laughing. And then I don't feel any of the, I don't feel as much of the gap between the audience and me. and then, you know.
That's lovely. That's a lovely thing to do. Yes, I think I've done occasionally things like that, just sort of improvising, talking as I begin. Yeah.
Yeah.
I guess one of the differences between where I work and where I work in places like Singapore and Hong Kong, they haven't really seen people like us before. Maybe now they have, but especially when I was beginning in the early 90s, mid-90s.
Okay.
In Singapore, I was the only person in the whole country with a unicycle. In the whole country. Okay?
Wow.
So, of course, I finished with the juggling on the big unicycle, which in London or probably in America would be a bit passé, a bit something that people have seen before. But in places like Singapore and Hong Kong, they hadn't seen that before, so of course I did that. But maybe in America, because they have, because there's more of you guys, and people are more exposed to it, I think that maybe that doing something more unusual, chatting to the audience at the start, your show is called The Cure for the Common Show. That can't be a mistake.
Right, yeah, well, it's nice to have a tagline like that, and I came up with it, and I was proud of it. The problem with it is, you have to, number one, you have to be, if you do everything stock, you feel like, well, this is the wrong guy for this title. I got to give this to somebody, you know, like, that literally lives up to that. So it keeps me from being boring, or at least I try to think of, you know, things they haven't seen, or something unique or whatever. But the other thing about it is, because it's sort of similar to Cure for the Common Cold,
that's
which is, you know, obviously a play on words,
yes.
Once in a while someone will introduce me and just slip up and say that.
Oh, no.
Yeah. And I'm sure the audience is like, I don't, what does that mean? How could this guy be the cure for the common cold? It doesn't make sense.
have you had a few bad, I saw a couple of your videos with bad, weird introductions and people talking about your name, pronouncing it wrongly.
Yeah, that's, That happens all the time. I don't know if you saw, there's one video of all the bad intros. There was one where a cruise director forgot my name completely.
Yes.
And
there's a long, is that almost just a long pause? Here he is.
7 seconds. It's to the point where you can hear people giggling, like, oh, they think, oh, this clever cruise director must be doing some kind of bit.
He just forgot.
Nope, just forgot, and
Oh. Oh dear. Okay. Let's. Okay. One more question about this. So, I'll probably come back to this later. But when you turn up to venues, if you're doing a long term, if you've got a long term booking, then the MC will get to know you and won't make any mistakes. But do you still do a lot of one off shows where you just turn up and do one show at one place?
For the most part, yeah, and you know, the cruise stuff has really sort of, for lack of a better term, it's kind of dried up for me in the last couple of years. I haven't really done any ships. The thing with, I mean, I don't know if it's the same here, but doing when you tell laymen you do cruise ships, it really makes an impression, because that term sort of conjures up such a
glamour
for world,
yeah.
Of it seems so surreal and substantial, and it's glamorous and all that's kind of nice, and it's sort of true. But that's the question I get more than anything, is, so how are the cruise ships? And I say, well, you know, I was never one of those guys that did 40 weeks a year or whatever.
Okay.
I always did, you know, enough that I felt like I know what this is like. I feel like I understand. I wouldn't say I understand that world, because it's a very bizarre, unbalanced system, but it makes such an impression on people, and that's what people ask all the time, like, so what's going on with the ships?
Yeah.
I guess it's such a bizarre thing to say that a juggler working on a ship, it just seems like...
Well, it's not easy, is it? Sometimes the ceilings are low, and the ship goes up and down.
Yeah, I mean, it's a really...
I think it's probably one of the worst possible places to do a show, I thought.
Yeah, well, yeah. In some ways, it is. It's, you know, if you don't lock the wheels on your cart, you know, it's you got one eye on that, one eye on the audience. Like, please don't roll across the stage. That up and down can be it just plays with the physics completely.
Okay, so you actually do a lot of just one-off solo, a one-off show, just in one place, or just a few shows in one place.
Yeah. Yeah, especially in the last 2 or 3 years.
Okay.
It's been mostly, you know, driving distance and one show, and then a handful of, you know, fly here to do one or two shows.
And are they, what are they corporate events? Are they shopping centers? Are they private functions? Is it a mix?
Yeah, it's a real mix. I mean, for me, I to be totally honest, I think I don't flourish in any one area, and it's still kind of a struggle of how do you become the guy that whatever in a certain area, and that's your thing. So I do, you know, I do some colleges, and I do some corporate events, I do some casino shows. All those are all the ones that I would fly for, and you know, I used to for the ships when that was really cooking along. But yeah, those three things really, sort of college, corporate, and casino, and you know, you mentioned at the beginning, it seems like, you know, I've done a fair amount of things, but it always feels like it's not enough.
No, you've done great. I'm looking at your website. It's wonderful.
Well, I appreciate that.
BrysonLang.com, is that right?
Yes.
Okay, people can check it out. It's really good.
Yeah.
So corporate shows, festivals.
Yeah.
Okay, how do you deal with the, just go off on a total tangent, how do you deal with some psychological stuff? You work alone, I guess, mainly?
Yes.
You travel alone. Is it a lonely life?
That's a good question. I think it was, you know, when I was doing long-term shows, between 2004 and 2009, I had a string of luck where I just kept doing long-term casino shows, long-term variety shows, and they were great, but there are aspects of it. Like, I spent a year in Tahoe, and a good portion of that was, you know, I was in a show, but you're still by yourself.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's a semi-remote area, and you know, you're in a hotel room for day after day after day, and it's not for everybody, but I definitely enjoyed the opportunity to sort of figure out, well, what can I do? What can I accomplish? How can I be productive? I think for the wrong person, it would drive them insane.
Yeah. Oh, I remember.
I just don't do that those shows as much anymore. I'd still love to, but yeah, for the really long term thing, if you're in a place like Laughlin, which is, I don't know if you know much about Laughlin,
no.
But it's sort of like Vegas, but it doesn't have quite the money or the energy.
Yeah.
It's a different feeling. It's like a smaller Vegas, and it's in the middle of nowhere in the desert.
Right.
And you know, I was there for many months, and you know, it could be tough for people to keep their faculties together. But I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, a lot of people don't realize a lot of our life is just sitting around in hotel rooms if we are overseas or far away.
Right.
I was in Abu Dhabi for about 2.5 months in the summer, and Abu Dhabi was so hot that you couldn't really go outside anyway, so you just sit in the hotel all day long until it was time for your show.
That's outrageous. Abu Dhabi, is that Ethiopia?
Abu Dhabi is the United Arab Emirates, so it's the Middle East.
Oh, that's right. It's
next to Dubai. Dubai is its famous sister city.
Yeah. There's a, I'm trying to think of the city in Ethiopia that sounds like Abu Dhabi.
Yes, there was Addis Ababa, maybe?
Addis Ababa, that's it.
Oh, I remember a question I wanted to ask you. This is going back a bit, sorry, I'm messing around with the chronology here. So, you say you do a lot of one-off shows, you go to somewhere, do a corporate event. How do you deal with the fact that maybe they don't know your act or... So you've got a. Are you self-contained? Do you take everything with you? Do you take your own microphone, your own?
Because
sometimes you turn. Sometimes you turn up some. For example, this is what I'm going to say. Sometimes I turn up to somewhere, and if I haven't brought my own stuff, they're completely. Sometimes I turn up and I haven't even got a sound system, so I always take along my own little sound system in Hong Kong. Hopefully, that's not a problem for you in America.
Well. Yeah, it's funny you should bring that up. I mean, a couple of years ago, until a couple of years ago, when I would get booked for a place that was, say, an hour away, and I'd get there, you know, you try to find out ahead of time what the resources are, and if there's a sound guy, and all those kinds of things. And some, like you said, sometimes there are, sometimes there aren't, and it can be very sort of disorienting when you're spending time there trying to figure out, okay, is there any sound, or what's happening, or you'd love it to be all taken care of. And I finally decided about 2 years ago to buy a sound system.
Ah, okay.
So I take with me, and it just is the greatest thing to have that confidence to bring your own sound, run your microphone and your music, and it's on remote. And it's not like it never goes wrong. There's occasionally issues, but for the most part, it gives me that confidence to come in, do a quick mic check. Everything's already plugged in, and I can concentrate on, you know, warming up and getting the show ready. So, yeah, that's been a lifesaver.
Ah, there you go. Same solution. I'm on the other side of the planet. I came up with the same idea. I take along a little. It's not big. It's about... It's a little speaker. I can plug in my iPod at the back, and there's a wireless microphone that links up to it.
Yeah, do the same thing. That's great.
Okay, so you don't have the problem of giving a CD to someone and trying to get them to right sound cue at the right time, that sort of stuff.
Yeah, I mean I do. So yesterday I did a show. I just used my own sound system, and that worked out well. You know, Wednesday it'll be different because it's a theater where they say, well, we have a sound guy, we've got it all figured out.
Mm.
And so I'll be running my sound still, because I'll do it through the remote, through the iPod, like you said. But I used to give my CD with a cue sheet.
Yes.
And, you know, not to sound ungrateful or anything, but almost every single show, and my friends and family can attest to this, almost every single show my sound was completely just wrong. And I think of myself as a fairly sort of organized, you know, straightforward, clear. I'd write down everything so carefully.
Yeah.
My cue sheets were impeccable, and I'd go... it'd just be completely wrong. And afterward, the guy would just go, great show. He'd never acknowledge it.
And
I'm just not, I don't have the personality to chew anybody out, you know. But it got to the point, it's so confusing. Like, how can this, the rehearsal was perfect. And the guy said, you know, he's got it. He gave me the thumbs up. Why is this a problem?
Yeah. The only solution I came up with when I used to take a CD was, the two things. The first thing was, always play the music before I go on stage.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'd wait till I'm 100% sure they're actually playing the music, and then I'll rush on stage. Don't want to rush on stage and then stand there waiting for the music to start.
Yeah, it's so awkward. And
and the other solution would be just to have it continuous. Just continuous. So there'd be the choreographed music at the start, and then I'd have some quieter music during which I'd do my talky bit.
Yep.
And then the music would start to build up, and I'd hear that, and I'd think, okay, it's time for me to start getting to my big finish.
Right,
That seemed to work all right, but it doesn't give you a lot of flexibility, and you can't have lots of precise comedy sound cues, the music coming on at just the right time, because it's...
Exactly, you have to guess.
Yeah.
I think one of my strengths is audio editing, so I decided when I was using CDs that maybe I would edit everything, like you said, in a way... to make less work for the sound guy, and then hopefully make the problems go away.
Yeah.
And the downside to that is I would put in breaks and things, and every time there was a false ending,
I know this.
They'd make the assumption they just stop the music.
Yes.
Oh, now we have to go back to the beginning. Like, now what are we gonna? That's worse.
Yeah, I had. Generally, right for 20 years, the first bit of my show has been rushing on stage and the music stopping and me looking around confused and rushing off. And that was not, I recorded those pauses on purpose for a...
Right, exactly.
But when it happened, you know, people say, oh, your CD's broken, or they press stop.
Yeah, I would tell them before the show, as I held the cue sheet, and I'd say, just so you know, I edited this. It sounds very convincing. Like, the music will stop as if there's a problem, and then I say something funny, and the music will pick up, and they're like, I got it. And when it happens, they jump on it, and they stop it, and afterwards they're like, man, I'm sorry, I thought that was a fake ending. I'm like, that's exactly what he said.
Oh, brilliant, brilliant.
Yeah.
Oh, dear. do you still get nervous before shows? You said you were quite nervous as a kid getting on stage.
I do. I think, you know, you get to a point where you know your show and you have a certain confidence with a certain percentage, if not all, of your act, and you feel like, well, that I can hang my hat on that, knowing that I know what to do from A to Z, and I'm comfortable with it, as opposed to in college where you thought, we just made this up yesterday. I don't know if this is going to work, you know.
Yeah.
And these are the people I'm going to see in the hall every day, and they're going to judge me up and down. So this is it's a little better. But, yeah, in terms of, I do. I know people that say they don't, but it's easy for me to admit I definitely do. I walk into it feeling good, and you wouldn't know it from talking to me before the show, but I feel it.
Yeah.
And it's all just the anticipation. Once the show starts, I feel fine.
Yeah, yeah.
But I definitely have nerves before show, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, me too, still. I remember when I started, and I'd be packing my box for my show, I wouldn't be able to talk to anybody. I was so, I just wouldn't be able to talk.
Right.
And now I don't have that now, but now I still do get nervous. Sometimes, just for no reason, I'll be backstage, waiting to go on stage, and it'll hit me. Ooh.
Yeah.
Yeah, strange. Never get over it. I guess it's a good thing. Keeps you focused, I guess.
Yeah, there's a way to, I have a quote that I wrote down on my wall here, and it says, "The pressure is a privilege."
Mm.
And I always thought that's, and it was from the tennis player Billie Jean King. But I always think of that when I'm before a show, and I think, well, this is a high pressure show. This is a big deal. There's a lot riding on it. I'm very nervous. Yeah. Please don't drop. All those things that go through your head. I hope they like me.
Yeah.
All that human stuff. And then I think, but I'd rather be doing this than most other things.
Yes.
And that's such a gift and such a privilege. So I always think to myself, you know what, the pressure is a privilege. It really is.
I've got so many quotes all over my wall as well. I've got one here. Corporate shows. Wow. I get to do my stuff in front of 1,000 people. How cool is that? That's just to remind myself that it's fun.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, originally it was when I first graduated from school, and my roommates were struggling for work and jobs and stuff, and they'd say, "So, how's it going with you?" And I'd say, "Good, good. I'm gonna go mountain biking, and then I'm gonna have a show later on today." But they'd have these they'd be sweating out the interviews for the 8-hour grind, and I think, you know, now that I'm getting older, I definitely appreciate the fact that they have insurance and safety net and consistent work and all that, but you know, it's not for everybody.
Yeah, let's talk about that. So, financially, I guess you've done great, fine. You've kept this going for many years, 20 years, I guess.
Survived. Yeah.
And how do you see it going on? Does that ever cross your mind?
All the time.
Me too.
All the time, especially now. I mean, I got married 2 years ago.
Uh-huh.
About 2.5 years ago, and there's sort of an added level of you know, responsibility and in a way, you know, you're sort of answering not just to your wife, but to her family. You know, you're representing yourself in a way, and so there's an added level of I don't want to say pressure, but just sort of responsibility to take care of things and to be a contributor and all that. And variety acts aren't normally known for their palatial estates and multiple car garage and all that. So I think, you know, I always looked at it like, to be able to survive, you know, sort of comfortably survive as a variety act is in itself feels like a success.
Mm. Yes.
And, but, you know, there's other levels that I'm always really striving to get to, and it's not always clear the steps. I relocated back to the East Coast from the West Coast in the last couple of years, and I'm still sort of learning how things work out here.
Yeah. And also, I mean, it seems to me there's a whole bunch of us in our early to mid-40s.
Yeah.
And is there a generation in their 50s and 60s? I don't see a generation in their 50s and 60s.
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, people that are doing it.
Yeah.
I mean, people that are out there. I mean, I definitely see the younger generation, but I don't know. the internet makes it so much easier to stand on the shoulders of those before them. So there's so many 14-year-old kids that are technically way better than I would ever be.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if they're in it for the long haul.
Yeah, I've noticed in Hong Kong and Singapore, sometimes you'll get people in their 20s having a go, but they don't necessarily stick with it. And the guys that I know in their 40s are still doing it, and they've been doing it like me for 20 years. And I say, we're going to be like the Rolling Stones. We're just going to carry on. We're never going to stop. Why should we stop?
Right. I'd like to be doing it as long as I can. I know that there's I have a friend who does this, and he's sort of set the model, I think, for me in the sense that he has a web design job that he does in conjunction with being a full-time performer, and he's very successful at both. That's, to me, is a brilliant way to make it work. That's a goal for me, is to sort of find something. You know, there's ways of using our time, I think, that can sustain two careers in that way.
Yeah, I think that's a good idea to be open to some sort of backup plan, secondary career that can fit in around what we hopefully can do. Hopefully we'll still carry on getting shows, but at the same time, you've got to be sensible. If it all does, something might happen. You might be in a bad accident and you can't juggle anymore.
And so right.
I think we need to have some backup plan.
Right, and I think it's safe to say it's too late for me to be a famous guitar player. I'll continue to play, but I don't have any delusions that I'm going to suddenly open for the Rolling Stones.
Does your wife work?
She's a teacher, yeah.
Oh, there you are. So you got two incomes.
Yes. Yeah, that's very helpful.
Yeah, my wife's a lawyer.
Insurance and all that is great, so that's,
Yeah.
That's nice.
Yeah, I think we have to be realistic. I remember when I was in my 20s, I was making loads of money for a 20-year-old. And I was making more than people like my wife who were started training to be lawyers. And this was amazing. And in my 30s, I found I was earning the same as the lawyers. And now in my 40s, I find the lawyers are earning way more than me.
Right.
But, I really love what I do, so I can't complain.
Yeah, definitely.
Again, sort of going off on a tangent, I saw you juggling with beach balls. And so I thought to myself, that's a good idea for transportation purposes, because they look huge on stage, but you can shrink them down to a tiny amount.
Yeah, that was the plan, really. I mean, I hadn't seen any. I'm not going to claim that I started it by any means, but I hadn't seen anybody else do it, and it just hit me one day. This is what I should do.
Yeah, yeah.
And so it became my closing thing for years and years. I haven't done it lately because I have some other things that I do, and it takes time to pump up the balls.
I know. I've used beach balls in this is amazing.
Yeah.
I have the same issues. I did a show for quite a long time. I had an act in my show called the Beach Ball Challenge where I'd put a roller bowler on top of my 3-foot-high magic box, stage box, and I'd be bouncing on that, and the audience would throw beach balls at me to try and knock me down. And, of course, the beach balls are so light, even though they're huge, they can't knock me down. And that was the act. But it was pretty tiring having to, even when you take the valves out, to inflate and deflate the beach balls.
Yeah, I mean, I've gone through many pumps, and actually when I was in China was when one of the pumps just completely exploded, and I think somebody, I never keep it straight whether we can plug things in or can't, you know?
Yeah.
And so somebody at that gig where I was performing said, yeah, it should be no problem, just plug it in. And, and it kind of worked for a little bit, and then it started to spin out of control, like Tasmanian devil, and flames shot out of it, and then it died, and it was just a bunch of broken parts inside.
Oh, God.
I had to walk the streets of Beijing trying to find another, another pump, which I did, but traveling with it overseas is tough.
Yeah, yeah. I used to use, you know the giant balloon act where people climb inside a giant balloon?
Yeah.
I used to use that pump to pump up my inflatable stuff, my beach balls.
Oh.
And when that broke, I realized I could buy, I think it's called a blower for blowing dry leaves. It was much cheaper.
Oh, yeah.
And I just put a little kind of, I just found something that would work as a valve to fit into the beach ball, and that's how I used to.
My favorite beach ball story is when I was performing in Laughlin, and I had three beach balls, and for some reason one day I thought I should pump up an extra ball, because one of these days one of them's going to pop.
Yes.
And who wants to see a guy with two beach balls? It doesn't make much sense.
Yeah, yeah.
And so the day that I bought a fourth beach ball and put it in my dressing area.
Yeah.
The crew's job was the crew would bring the three to the stage and then have them in the wings. And in bringing them to the stage, they popped one.
Oh.
And they thought, well, surely he has another one backstage. And they went backstage and grabbed another one.
Ah!
And then after the show, they said, like, oh, we grabbed your extra beach ball. And I was like, what do you mean? And they said, you had an extra beach ball. And I said, just today. I had.
Wow.
It just happened that day.
Oh, how lucky is that?
And I always travel with four, which is an extra, weight and hassle, but it gives me peace of mind. That just in case. Everything will happen eventually, you know.
How big is your suitcase? That's an issue for me.
Yeah, that's a tough one. I was using one of those Pelican cases for years because it's so bulletproof, but they weigh 20 pounds on their own or something.
Mm-hmm.
So I travel with a custom-made case that's extremely light, and then an additional duffel bag, and then a carry-on. And those three things are usually take care of it, especially if I'm only doing, if I'm doing 45 or less, that should do it. It's the rollable aboard. That's the part that's the hard part.
Yes.
It's in the duffel bag. But I am constantly trying to refine that, and my onstage setup and my travel setup is something I'm always very curious about how to make it streamlined.
Yeah, it'd be so nice to travel light, but I just seem to get my shows just seem to get bigger, and I see other entertainers who travel with a little suitcase. And I'm jealous.
I know. Absolutely. Yeah.
Oh dear. I was looking at your some of your videos, and you appear to have maybe your box or something into like a stage show box by wrapping some fabric around it.
That's been my, I mean, one way to save weight, I know it sounds obvious, was to use your suitcase as
Yes.
Prop stand, obviously.
Yes.
So that was my rudimentary attempt to conceal that.
No, I think that's I do the same thing. I came up, I got the idea from a ventriloquist who was traveling through Hong Kong, Michael Harrison.
Okay.
And I was looking at his box on stage. I think it's kind of a lumpy sort of stage box he's got, but it's very big. And after the show, I realized it was just a suitcase on top of two chairs. With fabric draped around it like a curtain to make it look like a stage, and it was great. Worked good the job.
Yeah, I'm so fascinated by people's stage setup. I personally feel like I need to have my stuff be able to roll.
Mm.
And I have other friends that don't mind picking the whole thing up and carrying it on or having someone else do it or whatever, but I really like that flexibility of being able to have it roll. So I have my box, and it's sort of bolted to, it's essentially just a file cart stand without the files.
Okay.
Because it comes apart. There's four legs and a frame, and they all come apart.
Yeah.
And it's a little on the heavy side because it's all metal, but it rolls really well.
Ah.
And it's what I've been using for a few years. From behind it, it doesn't look very... It looks pretty...
But from the front, it looks fine on the videos. It looks great.
That's good. That's good.
Yeah, I started off as a guy with wheels, and now I've moved to no wheels.
Okay.
I'm not sure which is best.
Yeah.
And if I'm doing a low-key show, I'll take my suitcase onto stage. If I'm doing a bigger show, then I have a kind of a magic looking box. It looks a bit like the stuff that it's a black box it's a big black box. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah. No, I sort of have two setups too. If it's a casual show, I can just use the box by itself, and the lid becomes another holder of things. And then if it's a more upscale show, then I use the full on rolling setup.
So, I guess you don't really have, an assistant traveling with you, so
right.
You have to get everything on and off stage for when your show begins and ends?
Yeah, I do. I think on the ships was the only time where they would ask you what you need and all that. I do it basically all myself.
Yeah.
And I try, another reason to keep it sort of minimal. The only other thing that I learned, I don't know, maybe 10 years ago, was it's nice to have not only your prop stand, but somewhere to put the stuff, like a drop, I call it
yes,
a drop.
Yes,
just an open bin of something, so when you're done with something, you can kind of dispose of it, so to speak, and then be right back in the audience's face without dealing with your stuff.
Oh, yeah, I definitely have a drop box, yeah.
I love that.
And same solution, different continent, yeah. And I also think that from one of the things that makes me happiest is being able to get everything on and off stage. Like the music begins, I don't even need any setup. Boom! I come onto stage, and my show begins, and then as the show ends, boom! I'm off stage. Everything's off stage, and if I work on a show consistently for a year or so, I can get to that stage. But when I start a new show, inevitably I have to spend 5 minutes putting everything on stage first. Then starting the show, and then after the show finishes, I have to creep back on stage for 5 minutes, picking up all the bits I've dropped all over the place. But my aim is to be able to have the stage empty, bang, my show begins, I can come on stage with no preparation, and then bang, the show finishes and get and everything's off stage already.
Yeah,
but it's kind of easy.
Like that. Oh, that's nice.
Yeah, what I do is I might just do a small trick as my very first thing. Like in a corporate show, I used to just come on stage and do the thing where you put a rubber glove on your head and blow it up.
Yeah.
And then bang. And then there'd be some intro music. And while that was happening, I'd wheel on my other stuff. And it seemed to work quite smoothly.
Yeah. That's a good idea.
And then at the end, I'd have a volunteer. At this point, I did a giant balloon act where I climb inside a giant balloon.
Okay.
And so while the volunteer was blowing up the giant balloon, I'd be clearing the stage of everything. So that once they did the giant balloon act, there was nothing else on stage except for me and the giant balloon, and I could just finish.
Right.
It's not easy. It takes a while to sort it out. And sometimes it's impossible. Sometimes you have to set things up and clear it off afterwards. Not easy.
I know. Yeah. I'm an MC of a USO tribute show featuring these three women that sing like Andrew Sisters and different songs through the years. And so when I'm working with them, I tend to come on and off stage, and that's where that's really important for me to be able to wheel it on and wheel it off, and then they're the focus of the show.
Yeah.
But for the most part, it's almost usually just me. I mean, most of the shows that I'm doing now. So if I finish and my stuff's all over the place, it's a little more acceptable. But I'm still very... very conscious of that, trying to keep things neat, and you find yourself waking up in the middle of the night thinking like, oh, I should put these here. And
yeah,
this.
I tell you, this is one of the things I'm addicted to. I just love the idea.
Yeah.
Forget about the actual show; just getting on and off stage. I love. I wake up the zoo thinking, oh yeah, that's what I should do to get off stage quickly.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. I am fascinated with people's prop stands, and everybody's got a different level of engineering. Mine's pretty small, but I do come up with some clever ways of attaching things to things.
Yeah, yeah. Brilliant.
Yeah.
Talking about neatness, your costume, is it that you seem to be sort of a, you're smart, but you're dressed normally.
Right.
Is it still a costume for you, or is there a reason?
You know, it's a good question. Of that whole, I started out thinking that the way you had to do it was to be very formal, and this was back when pleated pants were more acceptable, and
yeah.
I was wearing like a full suit,
yeah.
And then I kind of went to, I had these shiny short sleeve shirts that I would wear on a ship, and somebody in the ship business told me, you know, you can't wear short sleeve shirts if you're an entertainer.
Right.
And I thought, I see where they're going with this, but I don't think that's true, because nowadays I have friends that are doing all kinds of shows, and not only are they wearing short sleeve shirts, they don't even have a collar.
Yeah, yeah.
I think it's all kind of out the window these days. It's just a matter of the impression you make. I used to tuck my shirt in all the time, and have the belt and have that much more formal look. And in the last 10 years, I've gone with the untucked look.
Oh yes, your shirt's out. Yes, that's right.
Yeah, and I like the straight, mostly the straight across untucked shirt. And it's for two reasons. One, my mic, the way I wear my mic, the cable doesn't have to get kind of tangled up in the tucking in.
Right.
It sort of doesn't get all messed up with that. And then the other reason is with my remote, that the shirt covers the remote.
Ah, there you go.
On the belt. But also, I kind of like, you know, when you're moving around and doing pirouettes, and there's, you know, a few routines I have where I'm a little energetic and doing some juggling, and I hate always having to readjust my tucked-in shirt to try to look a certain way, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
So I don't know. My philosophy is I like the untucked but fairly put together. You know, trying to sort of balance that.
I have the tucked untucked issue sometimes. I always for some reason for me, I'm quite a shy person off stage. So when I was on stage, I was always being in some sort of outlandish costume.
Yeah.
Always bright colored sort of modern clown something costume, weird costume. I've always had that on, and I've normally tucked my t-shirt in, but sometimes it falls out during the show, and it annoys me that half the show it's out and half the show it's in.
Right. I also always wear, you know, formal shoes, and I know friends that wear. They'll wear sneakers or whatever, and it seems to suit them. But I always, for me, I feel like if I'm not wearing suit shoes with the suit pants and the untucked shirt, it doesn't quite feel right.
Right, right.
The shoes, to me, you know, make it sort of complete, although it does make it a little harder for some of the soccer tricks and all that, but I don't know.
I agree. I think whatever makes you feel, whatever feels right is what you should go for.
Yeah,
I feel right wearing some sort of outlandish costume, you know, polka dot clown or something unusual.
Right.
But if you feel right the way you are, that's what you need. Otherwise, you can't be yourself on stage.
Yeah, yeah. No, it helps. It definitely helps with that for sure.
Right, my next card says red panties. Wait, where did that come from?
Well, don't get me started.
There's a bit in your show, isn't there, of the dodgeball where you put on your red pants. Oh, that's great.
Oh, right. Those kind of things.
That's what it is.
Oh
yeah, sorry. We call in England pants and panties. I think we have a slightly different definition to Americans. Yeah. So you put on some silly red kind of shorts, don't you, over the top of your trousers?
I do. Yeah, I do. I hike those right up, and I don't know if dodgeball is as popular in the UK as it is here.
I think we know.
You basically get the gist of it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just two teams throwing balls at each other.
I think we know. Yeah,
the games are out. Simple and barbaric.
Similarities. I had a routine where I would put on my safety equipment before I got on my unicycle, and my safety equipment was bright red swimming trunks that I wore over my trousers.
Okay.
It's bizarre, isn't it, that we've never met, yet we come up with the same solutions.
I keep thinking, I mean, you know, I bought them, the whole routine is supposed to be, here's sort of an homage to playing, overcoming adversity from playing dodgeball when I was in grade school.
Yeah.
But I bought shorts that would fit a kid in grade school. So I keep thinking that somehow that, you know, the TSA is going to pull out, you know, why, Mr. Lang, why do you have a 9-year-old's pair of red pants in your thing? And I have to explain, it's part of my,
What's the TSA? Sorry, that bit I don't know.
Oh,
Trading standards or something?
It's the airport police.
Basically. Oh.
So I guess that would have been funnier if I had used an international term for that, whatever that is. the security folks at the airport.
Talking about, if you do shows overseas, do people get your verbal stuff, your spoken jokes?
That's a good question. I mean, I haven't done the only times I've performed.
But you worked in China and places like that.
Yeah. For the times I've been in Europe, it was mostly for the military, and those guys were mostly from the States.
Yes. Yes.
So I don't know how, as much as I grew up and currently really watch more, you know, BBC than anything else, and English, comedy has been the backbone, but I don't know how the UK would react to my humor, because I haven't performed for those audiences. In China and in Japan, it was locals, but it was also expatriates, and so it was a mixture of people from all over. And sometimes they got it, and sometimes they didn't.
Like, I'm sure things like the red shorts, that's so visual. I think the Asian audiences would get the slapstick. I think they'd love that stuff.
Yeah, that seemed to work. Yeah, a lot of the play on words or stuff like that just doesn't resonate for obvious reasons with a foreign audience.
Yeah. Well, that's
tough.
That's been my experience. I mean, if my career had been in the UK where I grew up, I think my show would have been much more verbal. But because I was working in places like Singapore and Hong Kong, Singapore they speak pretty good English, actually, but still, it's a different sort of dialect to us, and they won't get my references. So my act had to be, the comedy had to be pretty basic and broad and visual and slapstick.
Yeah, I think a lot of it is what you're exposed to and what you grew up with, and I think I would have trouble, if I were performing more for international audiences, I would have developed, I'm sure, a different act.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'd love to do more of that, actually, perform for more international.
Okay, here's some quick questions.
Yeah.
Music versus talking. Which do you prefer? Do you have a...
I think I feel more satisfied and more proud of a talking routine feel really connects.
Yeah.
If there's a comedic moment, though, that happens when the music is going, I kind of enjoy that, too, because I feel like I'm getting away with something that must have been thought through because the audience is laughing. Or sometimes you find those bits by accident.
Yeah, definitely.
But I like those, too, but I think talking.
Yeah, talking. Okay.
So.
Comedy versus skill. Which one do you... what are your thoughts on that? So, for example, if I'm on stage...
Yeah.
Sometimes I can tell they're not getting any of my jokes, so I try to pretend my show's skillful. And sometimes sometimes I'll drop some things a bit too often, accidentally, so then my show becomes more comedy.
Right. I would rather at this point. I mean, as I mentioned before, I think when I first got into juggling, my thought was, let me push the envelope. How much can I push the human endurance and the technical aspect of things? And definitely in my 30s and 40s, it's been more about the entertainment.
Yeah.
And I'd rather people come away from that thinking that guy was really funny, instead of anything else.
Really. Yeah, right. I think an audience is going to enjoy a really funny gag with three balls more than they're going to enjoy a seven-ball yeah. flesh.
Yeah. The analogy that I always used to give to laymen is, you know, when we watch Olympic figure skating, those of us that are not in the figure skating world, and we watch it, and we see an Olympic figure skater do a trick where they leave the ice, they do something in the air, and they land back on the ice, we immediately go, well, that was great, although I don't really know what just happened.
Yeah.
We don't know which trick that was, we just know it was good. You know,
yes.
when laymen see a juggler do something, they don't really know the ins and outs of it. They just go, well, that was good.
Sometimes the flashiest trick can be quite easy.
Yeah, it can be very counterintuitive. So I definitely, there's something to be said for how much of a punch does this pack, regardless of if it's really, you know, super technical, and they're not going to appreciate the difference really.
Yeah.
Between, you know, six or seven.
Okay, how about this one? On stage and off stage persona, is it the same?
It's very close. I'm a little more. The older I get, and when I do this, I do get. I'm getting goofier, and I think that comes from realizing that the best moments seem to come from the unscripted stuff.
Yeah.
And I know that's kind of a common theme, where it's common knowledge, but it takes figuring it out to really appreciate it. So I think the more that I go off book, the better that the shows tend to be, and the moments. They're better moments.
Sure.
You know.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
Yeah. So my persona has become a little more exaggerated, than who I am.
I think that's a common thread. Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
It's sort of it's you, but it's a very big exaggerated version of you.
Yeah. Yeah.
Cruise ships, comedy clubs, corporate events, casinos. Do you have a favorite venue?
Well, I have such a love-hate relationship with the cruise ship world.
Yeah.
You know, I the idea of getting a call from your agent and they say, "Do you want to go to Bermuda?" That's fantastic. That's the good side of it, and you get well fed and you travel around the world. It's like being a secret agent. But there's a lot that comes with that. That, like I said, it's a very unbalanced system. There's all kinds of. Gossipy and yes. political, and I don't mean to sound negative, but that's the truth of it. I think everybody's got their horror stories with ships.
Yeah, yeah.
I really enjoyed the casino shows that I did. There was really almost nothing negative about it. It was either right. one or two shows a night for weeks and weeks and weeks, and I never felt like anybody gave me a lot of rules.
Great.
They just sort of said, just
do it.
Let's do the best show we can do. And
Isn't that the best when someone says, here's your stage, here's your time, just do your stuff.
Yeah.
And the worst is when you surf and they say, okay, we want you to we want you to do like 5 minutes and then stop so we can bring an MC on for an award ceremony and then come back on again and do another 10 minutes. Just let me do my regular show?
Yeah. That first time I did the year-long run, the producer was nice enough to let me do substitute in three different shows. So instead of doing the same 20 minutes
lovely.
A year, I said, can I make up or sort of design three separate shows because I'll get a lot more out of it? And they did. So that was extremely valuable to me.
How long could your longest show be? I can do an hour solo if I have to.
Yeah, most of the shows I do seem to be 45, 50.
Wow.
And the ships usually asked for more than that,
ooh.
And I have a lot more material now, so I don't know how I did it back then. but, you know, back then it was like 55 and then an additional 20. And that's, you know, that hour and 15 is, that's a lot.
That is a lot. How do you fill that in? That could be a whole other podcast.
That was tough. And like I said, now I have, there's stand-up material I could pull from, and there's certainly a lot of, comedy juggling stuff to pull from. It's a lot easier, but, you know, ironically, I'm not doing the ships anymore, but I'd say an hour is comfortable, and 50 and 45 and 50 is, you know, is great.
Yeah, well, in Singapore it was always 30 minutes, so that was what I got good at. In Hong Kong, where I've been for the last 8 years, I was in Singapore for 12 years, now I've been in Hong Kong for 8 years, and in Hong Kong it's all over the place, it's either they want 10 to 15 minutes, or they want 30 minutes, or else they want 60 minutes, so I have to kind of keep on changing everything around.
Right. Wow, yeah, I like 30 minutes.
I think this is great. Flies by.
Yeah, it feels, it's a blink of an eye, but it's a nice amount.
Yeah, and the audience can focus quite right. Well for that time.
Right. I always thought it was amazing when somebody would tell me, have you done such and such a show? And I'd say, no, I haven't done that. What's it like? And they say, well, they want two, you know, separate one-hour shows, or they want like an hour and a half. And I'd say, I'm not Bill Cosby. Like,
yeah.
that's a lot of time.
You wouldn't want to be Bill Cosby right now, anyway. you say you have an agent?
Only for the ships I did.
Okay.
I had several through the years, and then at this point I don't have one.
Yeah, in Southeast Asia where I am, it's not an agent market for our kind of performers. We just get called up by entertainment companies or clients directly. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, I think it would be fantastic if there was one place that said, we love what you do, we support you, and we're going to find you work. I mean, that would be awesome. I haven't ever found that.
Wow.
Only for very specific things like ships or, like you said, occasionally somebody whose roster I'm part of will say once or twice a year, you know, hey, here's something that came up for a juggler, but...
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. I probably should start getting ready for my work later on. How about we start wrapping it up? Let's think.
Sure.
It's been fantastic talking to you. And you've been doing
it's
for about.
Pleasure.
It's really good, really, really good. You've been doing it for over 20 years, right?
Yeah.
How have you managed to keep up your energy and your enthusiasm for so long?
Well, I mean, part of it, as I'm sure you find, is new finding new material. I mean, it really breathes new life into your act when you come out with something new and you say, I'm excited about this because it's something different. I know they haven't seen it before. You know, even something as simple as ball bouncing, a lot of people haven't seen that.
Yeah.
And when you go in another direction and do something like that you're sure most people haven't seen, and you've got a routine you're comfortable with and you're confident, that's always a lot of fun. And finding these new markets, and when I first stumbled into the casino world and I started doing those for a few years, that was a nice wave to ride for a few years. That was really fun.
Yeah, definitely.
And to be in that, going from the theme park and private show market to sort of into these, you know, it was casinos where they had posters of the show. And
yeah.
It was sort of a different level. It was very exciting, and that definitely made me feel like, okay, this is not, I'm not going to be worried about the sound guy this time. You know, I know that this is all on a level where everything's kind of taken care of, and that definitely is very exciting. And then the international show, I mean, each type of venue and each chapter, it's exciting in its own way, for sure, for me.
Yeah, I agree. I think that things keep on changing. There's always new opportunities, new places to do shows, and you come up with new ideas, so it just keeps on re-inspiring you, doesn't it?
Yeah, oh, definitely. I mean, the times I went to Japan and China, for example, they were, you know, you sort of look around and think, how did I get here doing what I'm doing? This is great.
Yeah, if I'd known when I was 12 years old that I'd be on the other side of the planet from where I grew up doing circus, juggling shows, I wouldn't have believed it. I thought, wow, what a great career.
Right. It is funny when people ask you what you do, and if I say I'm a comedy juggler, they never get it the first. They go, sorry? Again, what was that? I mean, if I was a fireman, it would be very easy to say, I'm a fireman.
Yeah.
I know what that is. That sounds great. Let's move on.
And to bring us back to the start, that's why you say, oh, I'm like a magician.
Yeah,
oh,
exactly.
I see.
That's right.
Hey, Bryson, it's really, really good to talk to you, man.
Hey, I appreciate it. My pleasure.
Well, that was Bryson Lang. What a great guy. Wow. Once again, if you're an entertainer or you know an entertainer and you'd like to be interviewed, then drop me an email at ben@thebigbenshow.com. Once again, I'm rushing off now to do stilts. I'm doing stilt walking at the AIA Carnival in central Hong Kong pretty much every single day. So if you want to see me, come down and say hello. All right, take care, guys. Bye-bye.